information about the organization and enjoyed reading through that. And certainly do respect the work that you're doing. And I really hope that you're having a productive convention. Let us begin this afternoon. In the name of God the Father, who created us and provides for us. In the name of Jesus Christ, our Savior, who knows our human needs. In the name of God the Holy Spirit, who gives us faith and guides us day by day. Amen. Amen. Thank you. God give you a good convention.
Thank you so much. And now to introduce our presentation of colors from Girl Scout Troop 460 and lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, let me introduce to you Andy Tom.
Hello, we're Troop 460, and I'm Andy, as you all know, so ha.
I'm Jasmine.
I'm Alexandra.
Hi, I'm Camille.
I'm Andrea.
And hello, it's Leslie. And I am kind of an assistant helping with the troop these days, so here we go.
Please stand. Okay, the flag is in your heart, okay? There's no flag in here right now, I'm sorry. All right. Salute. Pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and
justice for all. Okay, you can sit. Bye.
Thank you, Andy. Super job, and thank you to all the members of Girl Scout Troop 460. I would now like to recognize the first presenter, speaker of the afternoon to lead us in a memorial to a great, great CCB member, someone who we all have known and loved for many years, Norma Schechter. To do that with us and for us this afternoon, I present to you the immediate past president of the California Council of the Blind, Catherine Skivers.
Good afternoon, everyone. Of all the days and all the times to get a kind of a frog in my throat, it's today when I want to pay tribute to someone that I love dearly, Norma Schechter. Norma was born in November 7th, 1919 in New York City, and she passed away January 7th of 2007. She was a resident of Huntington Beach for a long time, and she survived by her husband, Bernard, and her son and daughter-in-law, David and Harriet, and she has grandchildren, Anna and Michael. She was predeceased by her son, Jonathan. If you all read the Californian, and I hope you do, and if you don't, you better, you'll find a very fine article in there about Norma. So I'm not going to go through all the things she did, but I do want to tell you a few things. I want you to know that for over 50 years, and for those of you who are new to us, she was a sighted lady. And the Braille Institute had a transcribing course they gave, and they allowed you to have babysitters there for you. Well, that was her thing. She learned to do that. She became a transcriber, and she put things into Braille for blind people and visually impaired people for over 50 years. She dearly loved Braille. But I want today to have you know, I'm going to talk some more in a minute about what she did with Braille, but I want today to have you know the person, a little about the person, Norma. You know, all of us lead two lives. We have the life that we work with blind people, and then we have the life where we live someplace else. And Norma and her husband, Bernard, were married for 54 years. I called him a few days ago to see how he was doing. It may seem odd to some of you who are new to us that we're going to have a memorial service to start the afternoon things, but you know, that's what we're all about in CCB. We care about each other. I think that's what sets us apart from some other national groups. We really care about each other. We're concerned for each other, and we have time to stop and pause and think about somebody who dedicated their whole life to blind people. I asked Bernie how he was doing, and he said, as well as I can. He said, Norma was the writer. He said, I was just tagging along. But he said, now I realize I've got to do something with my time. And he said, I've written a book about my family. And he said, I sent it to my sister, and she liked it. And I said, well, does she not usually like what you do? He said, well, sisters sometimes don't. Anyway, he said, you know, Norma and I were adults when we were married. He said, I was 32 years old, and I walked up to her one day, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, Norma, I'm 32 years old, and I want to get married, and I want to stay that way, and I want you to join me, but we have to work at it. I want to take it seriously. I want it to work. And so he said that it worked pretty well, too. He said, now and again, though, he said, things got a little warm, and I just walked around the block, and by the time I came back, we usually worked it out. He said that when his son was in high school, he said, hey, Dad, I hear a lot about kids saying their parents fight. Why don't you and Mom fight? And he said, because we work at it. And I thought, that's Norma's life. She worked at her marriage, and God knows she worked for us. Norma was into everything. She organized the guilds for the blind in Covina, West Covina, and at Huntington Beach. And she finally moved to Orange County and to get closer to her home. She taught there for about 30 years. She was enormously interested in what went on. She did teach so many transcribers, and some of them are all over the world now. And she was known worldwide. She did all kinds of things. She did do transcribing of books, of course, but her favorite things were the life things, like if you needed a recipe or if you had to have directions on how to run an appliance or anything like that. She liked that. But she liked to do all the other things. She was certified in 1959 as a Brailleist, and she served on BANA, and she organized all the guilds. And, of course, she was proud, and we're so very proud that she is one of the sighted people, the very few sighted people, who are in the CCB Hall of Fame. She went in there in 1998. She loved Braille so much, and it stayed with her all her life, because late in her years, ironically, she lost her sight. And she had developed a book of jumbo Braille so that people who had difficulty with their hands could try to learn to read it. And she was very upset when she couldn't read it. And she came to Braille, and she knew Braille. When she came to the Braille Revival League, and she wanted us to try to find a way that she could learn to read the Braille. Well, she had the problem touching it. She couldn't. But here she was, finally, the last couple of years, bedridden. And she called me one day, and she said, well, Kathy, she said, I finally have to have someone look after me. She said, I have a lovely Filipino lady helping me. But she said, Kathy, do you know that in Philippines they know very little about Braille? So she said, I am working with her. I'm trying to teach her enough of it so that she can take it back there and share it. I've been kidding about we're getting to the point in CCB where I'm thinking about starting an octogenarian affiliate. And Norma sure would have been great in there. She was in her 80s, and here she was still teaching Braille to a caregiver to try to help somebody in a foreign country. I don't know what else shows more what she was than that does. She got involved in the California Transcribers and Educators and Visually Impaired Handicap, CTEVH, we all know it as, and she served on their board of directors, and she conducted workshops at their conferences, and she was editor of the 1970 to 75 of the California Transcribers, it's now known as the CTVH Journal. And she served on the BANA board and as literary specialist until 2005 on the other guild. She also served on the Braille Authority of North America, BANA, Literary Committee, and many others. She loved so much that she was so excited that finally the Louis Braille book, A Touch of Genius, by Mike Miller was published. And she got this idea, and I'm sure Bernie fanned himself when she told me on the phone one day, I want to buy everybody I know one of these books, one of these things. And I said, oh, Norma, I think that's a little big undertaking. I think some of us will be able to get one of those books. I don't suggest that you try to send them to everybody. She was very disturbed that the money from the Louis Braille coin should go to just one group. She felt that there were many, many groups that had been around for a very long time and it should have been shared rather than directed to one place. But she loved CCB, she loved all of us, and she called frequently. The last few years of her life, she would call Winifred and me and Audrey Hebner. She'd call us often, and she would call at startling hours. She would be awake doing things, I guess, and thinking, boy, could that lady think. And she thought day and night, and she would call Winifred like about 6 in the morning, and once in a while I'd get a call then. Of course, I get up with Daryl Skivers. When he gets up to go to work, we get up at our house at 4:30. And that's not bad. But then when you go and take a nap in a day, and then you call up maybe 9 or 10 or 11, Daryl and I are already, you know, most of the time we're fast asleep, we hope. But anyway, she really, really loved the whole work, and she was an author. She did 3 books, a Braille transcribing workbook, and that was to accompany lessons on in Braille transcribing by Bernard Krebs. She was really fond of him. He was the second Bernard in her life, she said. From which she taught her classes, and the world at my fingertips, she wrote, and that was the primer for teaching uncontracted jumbo Braille for our touch-impaired individuals, and most recently, a children's book for a little girl, young lady in Hawaii. And she never grew tired of thinking of things. She thought about the Braille Revival League, where she'd been a member and contributing a lot to them. And she really thought that Braille, she couldn't understand why everybody didn't want to learn it, and why anybody couldn't find time to try to teach it and help for everybody to learn it. But she was a very nice lady, and some people said that she had a Rolodex brain. She could just in a matter of seconds tell you where you could find something, what the resource was, what you could do, where you could find it, and she was always willing to help. She was never too busy. She was truly a lady. And Bernie said that of all the organizations she belonged to, he thought she had the most special place in her heart for us. And I told him she sure got a special place in a lot of our hearts in here too. And he said he recently has sent a contribution to the council. And he told me the other day, he said, I sent a little something to the council. He said, from time to time, as it works out, he said, I'll be sending along something else to you all. And I said, well, when you can, come and see us, because you're the other half of the family. After 54 years, you know, he is an accountant, and he's keeping busy. He sounds good. Of course, he misses Norma, as we all do. And I hope that when you get along things and you think you're busy, you have a lot to do, and you wonder what you should do with yourself, that you'll think of trying to do something for the lives of others. If you do just a little bit of what Norma did, you will really give her a tribute and leave her something to remember. I hope you will all remember her in your prayers, and I don't know where she is now, but if they got Braille, I bet you they got more books than they ever heard of.
Kathy, thank you very much for that presentation. Our next speaker began her work in the field of disabilities by spending 25 years in special education, working especially with dyslexic children. She obtained a second MA degree in counseling and she currently works in adult health programs for seniors. She's chair of the Synesthesia Association, and I'm excited to find out myself and to learn something about what synesthesia is. She's going to tell us about the basics and the implications of it. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Barbara Beard Steffen, PhD from the Center for Integrated Medicine. Barbara?
Thank you so much. Can I be heard? I mean, is my voice carrying? Okay. Thought I better work this out first. Is that better? Okay. A little. Okay, I'll get closer. How's that? Okay. Thank you. It's a delight to be here, truly a pleasure. I have not been a part of your organization before, but I was able to spend some time yesterday in the lobby of the hotel and met some of you and had some just really wonderful conversations, and I appreciated that. I'm going to speak a little bit about the definition of synesthesia, because it's a term that probably most people haven't heard, and part of my mission is to just help increase public awareness about what it all is all about. I'll also talk some about the history of it, some about the theories, including reference to some studies, and some of those studies have been involving blind subjects. I'll also talk about the prevalence of synesthesia. I'll share some about some case histories, some recurring themes I've noticed through the case studies and histories I've come across. And then I'll conclude with why I think it's an important topic to know about and to share with others. First of all, synesthesia refers to joined senses. Syn meaning union or together, and aesthesis meaning sensation. It's a curious phenomenon in which sensory images or qualities of one modality find themselves transferred to another modality. For example, middle C played on a piano may for one synesthete activate the experience of a deep red color, or for another synesthete, the same stimulus may induce the taste of raspberries. These pairings are automatic. They're present since childhood, and they're consistent across time. There are two general categories of synesthesia. One is synesthetic perception. Synesthetic perception refers to a synesthetic experience that is triggered by a sensory inducer, such as letters or digits evoking colors. The second is synesthetic conception. And this refers to a synesthetic experience that is triggered by a concept, such as the months of the year bringing about a unique, consistent graphic image. And as I share this, it's coming to mind that for many, they do these things by habit. It's just part of their nature, and they've never known it to be something that has an actual name for it, or it's an actual characteristic, and not something that everybody does. The most common form of synesthesia is colored letters, sometimes referred to as colored hearing. There are two types of this. One is referred to by some researchers as higher synesthetes, and the other term for the same thing is associators. People who are higher synesthetes or associators actually have colors that exist in their external space. Their colors exist in their internalized space. They're in their mind's eye. Now, for the lower synesthete or the projector, the colors actually exist in external space. So the colors appear to be in or around the text as they're taking that in as a stimulus. The colors coexist with the letters as opposed to simply being associated with the letters or whatever else the stimulus might be. I'll talk just briefly about the history of synesthesia. It was the first known reference to synesthesia was in some scientific writings by John Locke, and this was back in 1690. There was a reference in his work to the account of a blind man who described the color scarlet as the sound of a trumpet. It was described in greater detail in the 1880s by Francis Galton. He was especially interested in recognizing synesthesia in children. Since then, it has suffered repeated waves of dismissal as a phantom condition, despite continual reports of its existence. It became well known in the artistic community among composers, artists, and writers during the 19th century. And you may have heard of some of these writers and composers. Rimbaud was one. He wrote a poem about the letters being different colors. Kandinsky was another in both his artwork and his composing. Franz Liszt was another. Somerset Maugham was another. I mean, I could go on and on, but those are the ones that just come to mind. During the 1930s, due to the difficulty in assessing measuring subjective internal experiences and the rise of behaviorism in psychology, the study of synesthesia waned in the 30s. But then in the 1980s, the study of consciousness became respectable again, and the discussion of internal states became acceptable. So scientists once again began to study synesthesia. Recently, with the advent of brain imaging techniques, it has gained credibility in the scientific world as a genuine neurological condition, which has led to an acceleration in the research about it. It's really interesting. I do attend the American Synesthesia Association meetings yearly, and it's the one place in my life, in my career, where I can walk into an auditorium and I will be sitting with neuroscientists from top universities on my right and maybe an artist who, you know, has spent their entire life immersed in the art world on my left. It's fascinating in that regard to me, because it interests and involves so many different people and so many different disciplines. In terms of the theories or the causes of synesthesia, one theory is that it is a sensory cross-activation that's occurring in the brain. And this has actually been observed in through PET scans and functional MRIs. Such studies reveal activation of brain regions associated with visual perception in blindfolded synesthetes listening to words that evoke visual experiences. These activations were clearly different from those that were evoked in either non-synesthetes or the same synesthetes listening to tones that did not evoke visual experiences. Additionally, the activation of areas strongly associated with the perception of color was observed in a group of word color synesthetes, and this was not observed in non-synesthetes, even after they were trained to associate pairings of words with colors. Another study with synesthetic blind individuals reports that when they were listening to time words, words such as the days of the week or the months of the year, these evoked spatially localized synesthetic colors. Specific regions of the visual cortex were activated, just as it is in color perception of non-blind individuals. Current investigations are examining if this neurological trend is observable across subtypes of synesthesia involving other senses. Because if you can think about one sense that's paired with another, whether it's a tactile sense paired with visual or whether it's taste connected with smell, whatever two senses you can think about, there's a form of synesthesia probably that's related to that. Research with blind subjects who gave consistent descriptions of internal visual experiences with a two-month or more interim period after decades without vision suggests that there is a tenacious relationship between the activity of the particular neurons and particular perceptual experiences. That is, the visual areas of the brain can stay active after blindness. Another theory suggests that synesthesia could be the result of lessened differentiation of the sensory areas of the brain in the first months after birth. According to this theory, because of this increased sensory connectivity, some experiences between certain senses in the brain in infancy may stay fixed, suggesting that we were all synesthetes at one stage, but that sensory modularity developed more explicitly in non-synesthetes. Another thing about synesthesia to be aware of is that it does tend to have a genetic variant. It does tend to run in families. In some test and retest studies involving colored hearing synesthetes who had been blind for at least 10 years, they found a correlation between the colors they described for the names of the days of the week, the months of the year, and the letters and numbers, indicating that the visual areas of the brain remain active. For some, the meaning of the word was important in the colors they reported. For example, if they heard the word march in a sentence such as, "The band will march in the parade," the word march did not bring about any sensation of color. But if they heard a sentence such as, "The wedding will take place in March," referring to the month of March, then they did have that sensation. The same results were found for those with colored braille, a form of colored touch in which subjects saw colors while reading braille letters. And additionally, for one subject, he reported that with colored braille, the number 1, the musical note A, and the letter A in braille, all of which are represented by a simple dot in the upper left corner, were all the same color. The same color. Now, the incidence of synesthesia is a curious thing. The studies have indicated a wide range of numbers. Some studies have indicated that 1 in 21 people have synesthetic traits, and some studies reveal that it's 1 in 200, 1 in 2,000, 1 in 20,000. It was kind of a joke at one of the meetings I went to that the only number that the researchers could agree upon was the number 2, and that the number of zeros after it fluctuated. The study that I studied synesthesia in dyslexic and non-dyslexic children for my research, for my dissertation, and I did a couple of things. One, I used an online color assessment which involved letters and digits. And when I did that online screening, I found 1 in 21 subjects or children had synesthesia. And if I also interviewed all the subjects. I had 179 children that I worked with, and I also interviewed them. And in the informal interview, when I asked questions about other sensory modalities being connected to other sensory modalities that we wouldn't generally expect, I actually found 1 in 5 that seemed to have some synesthetic traits. The gender ratio is also interesting. Past studies have shown that there are 6 females to 1 male that have these tendencies. In the study that I did, and in another study that was done in Britain within the last few years, they found that the ratio tended to be 1 to 1. And I think that that may be because we were studying children, and they haven't become to the point where they're embarrassed about it or think that it's something that they shouldn't share. And boys in particular may not want to talk about pink letters. And so as they get older, they tend to let go of it, whereas the girls will kind of hang on to it. I don't know. That's just how I try to explain that. I'm going to just share a few of the experiences that a couple of the dyslexic children I work, synesthetic children, one of them was dyslexic, but I'm going to share a little bit about one dyslexic synesthete, a girl who was age 9, and a little bit about a boy synesthete who was age 12. And then I'm going to share with you a little bit, actually, something wonderful. It was an email that I received within the last week from a blind woman who has synesthesia, and I thought she gave me permission to share some of what she wrote, which I will do in a few minutes. But in terms of the little girl who was 9, and she also, as I say, was dyslexic, she has colors for the letters and the numbers. She noted that the sounds of the letters trigger the colors, which she used to help her memorize words. And being that she was dyslexic, this was quite an aid for her. She also said that names had colors for her, and that the colors of the names were determined by the first letter of the word. But then she added that the sound of the word made a difference too. For example, when she heard my name, Barbara, she said, "Well, it's a darkish blue." She said, "B is blue, but R is a dark red. And so that creates a darkish blue for me." She also said that names evoke personalities for her. She said, "The name Francis makes me think of a very neat person, like with black hair and just kind of very neat and trim and has like shiny hair and everything." She also said that personalities trigger colors for her. She said a really nice person would be a light color, and that a really mean person would be a darker color. Just like sometimes mean, sometimes nice would be like a middish color. Then a super nice person would be a bright color. This child also played the harp, and she said that musical sounds evoked colors in her mind. But for her, each note's letter determined the color of that note. She added that for an easy song, it helped to remember the order of the notes, but not for a complicated song. She definitely was using her colors to help her learn. And she said that she didn't realize that everyone didn't do that until she was 7, which was only 2 years prior. And when I asked her how she felt about her synesthesia, she said, well, it's fine. It's just part of me. It's how I learn. Now, the boy, age 12, he, while I was interviewing him, seemed to become more and more conscious of his synesthesia. And this happens because people who have synesthesia don't realize that it isn't anything unusual, but once they start to think about it and they're questioned about it, they realize they have more forms of it, and it's they just sort of have a different perspective of it. This fellow said, whenever I think of, you know, Tuesday, I think of the color red. And when I think of the number 7, I think of the color yellow. And for the note D, I think of kind of a flat texture. I'm thinking, well, that's cool. I can associate that with that, and it never really occurred to me before. And regarding his associating textures with musical notes, the texture of the musical note comes to mind for him before the letter of the note. He said, textures can be like images, and I kind of see the textures. B is a high, roundish hill. D is virtually flat with a slight dip, and C is a vertical plane. For him, numbers also have genders. For example, for him, 1 is a female and 2 is a male. And it goes on and on. Doesn't stop there. Numbers for him also have a place in space relative to his personal position, with the larger numbers moving away from him in space and becoming smaller in size. He said, so if I see a printed number, I don't just say there's a printed symbol. I think of where it is. During the interview, he realized that he often comprehends what he sees or hears in terms of associations rather than isolated symbols. For example, his numbers in space help him to conceptualize their values. He also has a sense of the months of the year, flowing around him in reverse order from December to January. And it was noted that during this interview with him, he just almost became mesmerized as he was just thinking about how this all was. And it was just such a part of him. But it seemed that his self-awareness grew as we talked. Now I'm going to read to you about the blind synesthete and what she wanted to share or wanted me to share about her experiences. She wrote, each letter of the Braille alphabet always has had an assigned color. And that color has never changed. In fact, each of the 63 characters of the Braille code has an assigned color. This synesthete reports being able to see the numbers from 1 through 100 at a glance in a set pattern. But what this individual actually sees is a color representation for each number. For example, 6 is a patch of yellow between the patch of orange, which is 5, and the patch of medium green, which is 7. This ability to see numbers in a spatial pattern is viewed by this synesthete as a great help in often being able to do mathematical computations without the need of a calculator or other aid. She continued to write, the months of the year and the days of the week also always have had fixed colors assigned to them. Both are arrayed in a circle, but the circle for the months is, of course, larger in diameter than the circle for the days of the week. Again, there are color representations for each day or month rather than the name of the day or month appearing in color. Saturday is the orange patch of color between the red patch of color that is Friday and the white patch of color that is Sunday. This synesthete sees streets in color, with the color sometimes but not always seeming to reflect the color of a letter in the street name. This ability to see streets in color is cited by this synesthete as a great help in traveling independently and or helping others to navigate while riding in a vehicle. This synesthete also sometimes sees, and it is a sense of seeing rather than knowing or imagining, color when listening to music, but the associations of music to color are not as highly developed or as complex as the colored language linkages. So as I look back over these studies, I came up with just a few themes that I saw repeating themselves. These people, each of them, could not imagine life any other way. They each noted that their synesthesia in some way provided a way of learning for them. Their synesthetic experiences remained constant. They each commented how difficult it was to describe their synesthetic experiences with words. And the children did not express any feelings of embarrassment about their synesthesia. This has not really been true of the adults. I've noticed a lot of adults have more embarrassment around it because they've either been told in the past that it was strange or weird or that other people didn't do that. So they tend to become more self-conscious. I think it's important to consider synesthesia as a learning style. It's an ability. It's not a diagnosis. It can be developed and nurtured. For example, in children who have it that are allowed to welcome it and to talk about it and to be with it, it expands, it grows, and it becomes useful for them. It can even become a tool for learning. It's also a channel to creativity. Increasing awareness awakens one's senses, and it enhances attention to the synesthete's inner world. It's also seen as a direct link to the unconscious. As a matter of fact, some of the researchers in neuropsychology who are studying it feel that through this study of synesthesia, they're going to be able to find the window to the unconscious, something that philosophers and scientists are very interested in, of course. I feel that it's important to know about synesthesia. One of the reasons that I decided to study it fairly thoroughly was because of the people that I had met and talked to who really had self-esteem issues around it because, again, they were embarrassed about it. And again, it's considered by those who have it to be a gift and they can't imagine life without it. I think that it's important because it increases our awareness that people all have unique ways of perceiving our world. No two people perceive our world the same way. I think increased awareness of synesthesia will help those who have it and feel stigma about it to rise above their discomfort and to recognize it as an attribute. And it will also help those who have it to expand their consciousness and to open to undeveloped sensations and abilities. In 1880, that long ago, Francis Galton said, "I conclude that where they, meaning synesthetic experiences, are vivid and serviceable, they are much used and insensibly grow in vividness, in definition, and in automatic character. Otherwise, they decay from disuse and become forgotten." I have a handout that I will leave for anyone who's interested that lists three different websites on the internet that you can learn more about synesthesia from. Well, there's actually many, 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 many websites, and of course one will lead to many others. But the ones that I wanted to bring to your attention are on this sheet. The first one is regarding strong visualization skills among the blind, including seeing with sound research that with the voice at Harvard Medical School, which maybe you're all familiar with. But in March, there was an Australian broadcast, and this broadcast is actually available on the internet right now if you want to go to that website. There's also an NPR program on synesthesia called The Infinite Mind, which was recorded in 2005, and I have the link to that. And then there was also a 60 Minutes broadcast in August of 2002. So I'll leave that behind, and I'll also leave my name and contact information in case you want more information about this topic. Anyone have any questions? I'm looking at my time. It looks like I think I have a few minutes to address questions.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay.
For those who have questions, please come to the aisles. There are volunteers who will help you find the mic stand nearest to you.
Pete Romero?
Yes.
I'm curious to know whether any of the people that were studied had been blind since birth and never saw color.
That actually is an area that they are beginning to work more closely with right now. Most of the studies are with people who developed blindness as, you know, after having had sight or vision, but not all. I mean, as I say, this is a very new area, and I encourage anyone with interest in it to pursue that. Uh-huh.
This is Pam Pology from the San Gabriel Valley chapter.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for your interesting topic. speech. My question is, in your studies, have you been able to link any kind of, or notice any link between the I can't pronounce the word.
It's a tricky one.
Between that and ADD or ADHD?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes, there is research that is showing that there tends to be a higher incidence of ADHD among the synesthetic population. But there's also contrary evidence, but some research is indicating that. I was hopeful that my research would indicate a higher percentage among dyslexics. I didn't find it was significant in my study, but I still keep hearing about it, and other people are curious about it, so I'm not convinced it's not true. But in terms of ADHD, yeah, there's a lot of talk and, again, more research going on. Yes?
Yes. How does this? This is Beryl Brown from Santa Rosa.
Hi.
How does this relate to the Charles Bonnet syndrome?
I actually don't have any information about that. I'm sorry to say. I don't know if there's a relationship. One thing I was thinking to share was that in my study, although I did not find a higher incidence of it among dyslexic children, I did find a higher incidence of it among children who were attending a school for advanced children. So I think children who are encouraged and, you know, tend to have great interests in many things that are more, you know, in the higher intelligence range tend to have a higher incidence of it. But, no, I don't know. I haven't heard about that specifically.
She already asked my question. Now I've got to think of another one. What I was wondering that too, the totally blind people, if you're totally blind and you can't see nothing, not even light, how could you have it? She already answered that.
Right. Well, again, that's something that researchers are looking at almost as we speak. And they're noticing that there tends to be areas of the brain cortex, the vision cortex area of the brain, tends to be triggered by other modalities. And they're looking at how this could relate to non-sighted people and how that might be able to bring about visual images for them that they might not otherwise have. So
that theory that that it's that all the kids have it and that all the babies have it, and then when they get older they tend to lose it because of society and stuff like that. It's sounds like that's more a relevant theory, because if you said that blind people can have it too, because I don't know, I wasn't actually born blind. I was just, like, could see for about 2 hours, and then it probably just stayed there after that. I'm not even sure if I have it or not. So. To find out if you have it, or you want to know if you have it, or you think you have it, or something?
Well, I would encourage anyone who thinks they might have it to do some research on these different websites. To, you know, just become involved in what information is out there and what studies are being done. Yeah. One thing I want to make clear, because maybe I didn't make this clear exactly, is that two things. One, that this theory that we are all born as synesthetes and that certain areas of the brain close off, not allowing this cross-activation or whatever it is that's happening, this would mean that you either those areas of the brain are closed off or they're not. If they're closed off, you won't be a synesthete. If they remain open, then you would be a synesthete. Now, that's different than you could have those areas open, allowing synesthesia to be occurring, but if it's not encouraged or it's not welcomed by the individual, and if it's discouraged by others, then, of course, it probably would get closed off within the individual. Then they wouldn't have the synesthesia as predominant to them as otherwise. So it's kind of two different things. I don't know if I'm saying that very clearly.
Barbara, thank you very much for your presentation. Ladies and gentlemen, Barbara Beard-Stephan.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. And I would certainly like to have a copy of your handout. And maybe the best thing would be to leave it down at the that far end of the table with near the membership material that Artis has down there.
Okay. Thank you all very much.
Oh, okay. Back of the room, on my left, is where this is going to be. Back of the room on my left. So as you're sitting, it would be actually on your right, but behind you. We're now going to deviate just a little bit from our schedule for a moment. As many of you know, in the California Council of the Blind, in the spring of each year, the nominating committee meets and recommends a slate. During the time from this convention until the fall convention, the membership can consider that slate. And in the fall, in Southern California, we will vote and decide who will succeed those people whose offices are up this year. The chair of the CCB nominating committee this year is Rob Turner. And Rob, I now recognize you to deliver a report of the committee.
Okay, oh, there we go. Thank you, Chris. We have seven positions that are up for election in the fall, two officers and five board positions. And they are, now let's go over the positions first. The second vice president, currently Eugene Lozano Jr., of course, the secretary Rhonda King, and then the five board positions, Jerry Arakawa, Ann Kaiser, Peter Pardini, Richard Ureda, and Jane Cardis. Her term is expiring. Okay. So basically, the nominees are those same names: Eugene Lozano Jr., Rhonda King, Jerry Arakawa, Ann Kaiser, Peter Pardini, Richard Ureda. And the position the position occupied by Jane Cardis, the nominee is Steve Fort. So that's the slate. I want to say that all five board positions had competition. There, only the two officers were nominated by acclamation. And I want to thank the people, the chapter representatives, for their support. It was my first time as nominating chair, and they were very supportive and very helpful, and I appreciate that. So that's my slate. Thank you very much. That's the slate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. Congratulations getting through your first meeting. That's wonderful. Out in the sort of the foyer to this room, which is a hall that goes halfway up and down the hotel, we've got many exhibits, lots of people with tables to provide information, people with tables to sell things. One of the exhibitors out there is a local organization to the Sacramento area, but an organization well known throughout California, Society for the Blind. And to speak with us today about the society and talk with us about new programs, new possibilities for the society, is its fairly new executive director. Ladies and gentlemen, I recognize and introduce now to you Kevin Dugan.
Well, thanks very much for having me here today. I am thrilled to be here this afternoon. I am especially appreciative to be able to get out of the house today. My wife works for the UC Davis School of Medicine, and for those of you who are Sacramentans or folks who live in this community, you know that today is picnic day out at UC Davis, which is their big open house. needless to say, rain throws a bit of a wrench into picnic day. And so my wife was out there, and I thought she was only going to be out there for an hour or so this morning. And it turns out she was there till about 1 o'clock, which is fine. But we have an 11-month-old son at home that I was taking care of all day today. And I love my son. He's the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. I can say that because my wife's not here right now. But he's a heck of a lot of work, I got to tell you. You know, he's always there. You know, he's always tugging on. He doesn't walk yet, but he crawls fast and he tugs on my pant leg. And I'm thinking, you know, don't you have any friends? Don't you want to go play mud football, or don't you want to do something like that? And so he just kind of looks at me and smiles, and so I melt. And today, if I changed one diaper today, I must have changed six diapers. And you know, as I mentioned, he's starting to crawl now, and so it's a challenge changing diapers because he's crawling while I'm trying to change him. And so I gently but firmly, you know, bring him back and put him on his changing table. And then he starts crying. And I'm thinking, listen, I'm changing your diaper. I should be the one that's crying, you know. You think this is a lot of fun for me? So my wife has made it home, and so I'm happy to come out and have some adult time with everyone. So thank you. I've been asked to talk a little bit today about society and some of our future plans. A lot of you have probably been hearing about a building and a new facility. So I do want to talk about that a little bit. And more importantly, what that new facility will bring to us is some increased opportunities for programs. For those of you who are from this area, or if you're not, you might not be aware that the Society for the Blind was founded in 1954. Is anyone in this room part of that? Was anyone happen to be part of this founding of the Society in 54? No? Okay. Well, then I can make some things up then, and no one will probably know the difference. But I know Audrey will know the difference. Audrey wasn't far behind 1954, but 1967 probably, when the Society moved to our current facilities on 24th Street. It's a facility that was built in 67 by the local Lions Clubs, and the Lions Clubs still own that facility. We pay the whopping sum of $1 a month rent to operate out of that facility. But that facility has long outgrown its usefulness. It's about 4,500 square feet. We outgrew it a long time ago. At the Society, we have 45 staff. We have several locations. We now rent space across the street. We have a house out in Natomas that we work out of, et cetera, et cetera. So we've been in desperate need for a new facility. I joined the Society about 3 years ago. In fact, my three-year anniversary was just yesterday. And after I was there for about a year or so, we were ready to go out and try to get a new facility for the Society. Now, in doing so, it was a little bit like, did anyone read the story last year or is familiar with it? It's the guy who was in Canada who traded, ultimately made 14 trades on the internet. He started with a red paperclip and ultimately ended up with a house. Does anyone remember that story?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's kind of how we've operated so far, in a similar kind of vein. We didn't have a red paperclip, but we had a dream of needing a new facility. We wanted a facility that was about 20,000 square feet. We wanted it to be close to light rail. We wanted it to be in the downtown area, and preferably in an area of Sacramento called the R Street Corridor, which is an area that's under renovation currently, and it's going to be a very, very popular and well-traveled area. So what we did was we talked to a local developer, and we found a building that met that criteria on 1238 S Street, for those of you who are from Sacramento, and two blocks from light rail, 20,000, a little more than 20,000, 20,500 square feet on two floors. And so it completely met our criteria. The problem is that the Society hasn't done very well in fundraising over the last 50-some-odd years, and so we have no money to spend on a building. So what we were able, though, to convince the developer to do is to sell that building to us instead of $3.2 million, which it was appraised at. He agreed to sell it to us for about $2.1 million, which sounds great, almost 60 cents on the dollar, but where are we going to come up with $2.1 million? So we hire a fundraising consultant firm. They go out in the community. Now, the Society for the Blind has never gone out to this community to ask for support in any type of coordinated manner. So this was the first kind of putting our toe in the water and testing the community for support. It turns out that the fundraising consultants came back and said, you know what, we think there's at least $2 million out there for you to raise. So we said, okay. So we brought that back to our board, and I kind of held my breath and said, listen, board, here's the deal. I want us to buy this building. I know we don't have any money, but I think it's a good idea, and I think there's $2 million out in the community. And they kind of looked at me like I was crazy and wondered why they hired me. But ultimately, they thought, well, you know what? We already have $1 million in equity in this building, and if everything went terribly, we could go ahead and sell this building and put $1 million in our bank account. So with that kind of line of thinking, they took a calculated risk. And to make a long story short, we have now raised about $2.3 million from the Sacramento community. Which is enough to purchase that building, and now we're working on the renovations. On the renovation side, there's a reason why this developer sold us this building for $2.3 million. Mainly that roof, which is probably in this rainstorm leaking like a sieve right now, but it certainly needs a lot of work. Well, I kind of took the same approach with this that we did previously in terms of the renovation, and I approached some folks that I knew, mainly my brother-in-law, who's an architect at one of the largest architectural firms, HMC Architects. They have four offices throughout the state of California. And I said, Arturo, you know what? I said, I'm going to find some architect to do the design for the renovation of this building. And I'm not necessarily asking you to do it, but what I don't want you to do is I don't want you to come back to me later on and say, gosh, I wish you would have asked me to do it. So, being that he's my brother-in-law, he signed on board. We were able to get the principals of HMC Architects to do all the drawings for us at no cost. We've had John F. Auto, Inc., which is a giant construction firm who did the big new airport parking lot, probably a project that many of you are familiar with. They have been donating all of their services. ESC Design Group has donated all their services. And to make a long story short, we've raised about $800,000 in in-kind services for the renovation. Now, the renovation is about a $2 million renovation because they're gutting the entire building. So we still have about $1.2 million to raise, but given the support that we've received in the community so far, I'm real confident that we're going to be able to do that. And in the meantime, because we don't want to wait until we have all the building, we are going to start building out the building in phases. So it's a three-phased approach, and as soon as we get some help from... Well, one of the challenges right now is that that $2.3 million is pledged over a period of 5 years. So that money is coming in over a five-year period, and the folks that we do have to pay, we do have to pay some of the folks who are helping with the renovation. They're kind of funny in that they don't like to get paid over a five-year period. So we need to get a little bit of money up front from one of the banks, and we're working on that right now. But we hope to start the renovation process at the end of May or early June and hope to be in early 2008. Now, a new building is certainly nice, but we're really doing it because we need the programs and we need to provide better services to people who are blind and visually impaired throughout this region. But let me just tell you a little bit about what's going to be in the new building and talk a little bit about some of our programs that have started to expand and will be expanding much more depth once we get into the new facility. But first of all, as you walk in the building will be our store. Right now we're in a closet-sized space. It's called the AIDS Independent Store. We are online at societyfortheblind.org, but we still don't have enough space. So as you walk in the new facility, first of all, there'll be a very welcoming and open entry area and waiting room. To the left, there'll be a store that's about four times the size of our current store, which will be able to carry much more and many more products than we're able to currently carry. There'll also be a computer lab that's open to the public, and it'll have all the accessible technology on the computers. There'll be CCTVs, there'll be brailers. So for folks who don't have the adaptive technology at home or might not have the latest version and they want access to that, that is something that will be available to everyone. Our low vision clinic will be expanded. We'll have a student break room. Many now of our students are here at our facility all day, and there's no place for them to put lunches, coats, and just kind of hang out. So there'll be a student break room. There'll be a Braille production facility. We have four full-time drivers hours. We do pick people up within about a 60-mile radius of the agency, and so they'll have some space there. And then on the second floor will be all of our teaching space. So we'll be teaching our core teaching programs of Braille, daily living skills, computer technology, and orientation mobility. We'll all have space. Our senior impact program, which has had very limited space at our current facility, they've been doing most of their work out of the residential home in Atomas, will have space. Our career development program, and I'll talk a little bit about more about that in a moment, but our career development program is one of our most important programs, we feel, and it's a program that's really blooming. We have been forced to rent space across the street, and thus we've been real limited in the number of participants in that program. And then our youth program, we don't have any space for youth. So all of our youth programs are limited to weekends, to a summer camp, to things like the Blind Olympics, other things that we don't have to use our current facility for. So we're going to have some dedicated space for our youth programs. Of course, California Access News will be located on the second floor. And we'll also have a large conference room, which will seat about 100 people, which is important for us because we really see this new facility as being a real community resource. And so we would love to have CCB meetings there. We would love to be able to offer it to other partners within the community to have a place that they can call their own to meet on a regular basis. So those are some of the amenities in the new building. A couple of cool things that I think we'll have and a couple kind of stories that went along with them. We've been jammed at the back of an alley for the last 50-some-odd years, and so one of the things that's been important for us is to gain some more visibility in the community. We want to be right in the heart of a well-populated area so that people know that we exist and what we do. And so one way we've decided to do that is around the exterior of the building, there'll be a metal band that has perforated holes in it that basically spell out our mission statement in Braille, and it'll be backlit so that all around the building the community will have like this starlight quality of and at least draw curiosity to the building and maybe answer some more questions or ask some more questions about who we are and what we do. Well, the city of Sacramento has been a very, very good partner. They really want to see this happen. But they kind of are in a little bit of in-the-box thinking. And they said, you know, that's a great idea. You know, the architect did a nice job out, you know, drawing the pictures and everything. They said, gosh, this is beautiful. We wish we could do it, but we can't. And we said, well, why can't you do that? And they said, well, we have very, very strict sign regulations, and that's too big for a sign. And we said, come on, it's not a sign. We said, you know, first of all, anyone who doesn't know Braille can't read it, and even someone who does know Braille, it's oversized, and no one's going to be up there, you know, with hands on giant Braille. And so luckily, common sense came into play, and they said, okay, we'll call it an architectural feature of the building. And so that'll be there. The other kind of fun we've had with this is the city, it's in the core area of the city, as I mentioned, and there's 45 parking spaces associated with this. And the city hates to take out parking spaces. They just despise it. They don't want to do it. Well, we really felt like we needed an area for our guide dogs because we have, of our staff, five of them have guide dogs and many of our students have guide dogs. And so we wanted to make sure that there was a guide dog relief area and rest area. So we approached the city and said, listen, we need to take out six of those parking spaces because we want to kind of create a nice little dog area. And they said, well, no, you can't do that. We can't take out any parking spaces. And we said, well, first of all, you know, if we don't do that, you really don't want to have guide dogs going up and down your street looking for a place to relieve themselves. And they agreed. They said, yeah, well, that's for sure. And then we said, you know, we really don't need that many parking spaces because we're a society for the blind. And we have a third of our staff are blind, and they're not driving. And our students, they're not driving. So we don't need 45 parking spaces. And so they kind of said, okay, yeah, I guess you're right. I guess a dog area is more important to you. So we'll have a guide dog area, to make a long story short. So it's they've been wonderful. They've really embraced this, but it took a little bit of out-of-the-box thinking for them. Anyway, in terms of our programs, and then I'll wrap up, as I mentioned earlier, our career development program is something that's extremely important to us. It's been extremely successful over the last year. In 2006, we had 48 people participate. Of those, 60% to date have achieved competitive employment. And of those that achieved competitive employment, we did a little survey and said how many of them are still in their current jobs after 90 days, and nearly 90% of them were. And so that... Thanks. And so that doesn't mean also that the 40% haven't or will not find jobs. It's just that they haven't found jobs yet, and they're still out looking for those. But so that's something that's extremely important for us. That's turned into a statewide program. So we've had people from Southern California, from Bakersfield, from other areas that have participated in that program. We have four components to that program that I can talk to you a little bit more about. They're for individuals who are looking for a vocational exploration, who know that they want to work but they just don't know what they want to do. We can help them with that. We also are working with some employers: California Franchise Tax Board, Vision Service Plan, Wells Fargo, Maximus Foundation, where they have customer service representative jobs or call center jobs, and we've been helping get people jobs in those areas. And those people who want to work in a certain area that doesn't fall into that category but just need to brush up on their interview techniques, their resume, writing, etc., we're helping them do that as well. And then finally, our youth program. As I mentioned, we would like to start having a program for preschool children and their families. We'd like to do more in the youth transition in terms of helping youth get into the job market and after-school programs as well. And finally, we do hope to have a partnership with Guide Dogs for the Blind. We've had some preliminary conversations about them having some space and having some Sacramento outreach through that as well. So there's lots more that I can talk about, and I can go on for a long time, but I know that I've run out of time here, so I can stick around and answer any questions, or I can answer any questions that might that anyone has right now.
Kevin Dugan, thank you very much. If you have questions for Kevin, perhaps you can meet with him in the back of the room, or when we break. We do have to move along at this time to our next speaker. But Kevin, great to have you. Congratulations on the building. We are going to modify our agenda slightly because we have an opportunity to hear from someone that I know will be interesting to most, if not all of you, in the room. He is a solo law practitioner, lawyer, I think we call that, in Washington, D.C., with working currently with an emphasis on health and disability-related clientele. And boy, does this guy have credentials. He has been admitted to the bars of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, U.S. Court of Federal Claims, D.C. Court of Appeals, and the Superior Court of D.C. He can serve as a hearing officer in a number of states, including South Carolina, Texas, Arizona, Maryland, and practices a whole range of legal work, including trial litigation and appeals, motions, arbitration, administrative hearings, and responses to regulatory actions. I've got actually 8 pages of information that I could tell you about our next speaker. I have to mention a few other highlights. One is that he has a degree from my alma mater, the University of Washington in Seattle, among many others. Most notably, I guess, of the others, a George Washington University Law School law degree. He is known to many of us in the American Council of the Blind as Mr. Randolph Shepard, vending advocate and expert. He served for many years as an appointee of the president, confirmed by Congress as the Director of the Rehabilitation Services Administration. He does have a personal life. He's married and has two children, both of whom are one is a professor, the other is an assistant professor, one in the medical field, the other in computer science. Ladies and gentlemen, I know that you'll be very interested to hear from our next speaker from Washington, D.C., Mr. Robert Humphreys.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Chris, for the warm welcome and for your California hospitality, even though the liquid sunshine out there is not quite California. Yeah, Washington's not all that great either, is it? Chris, I don't know if I can live up to that glowing introduction, but I'm going to try my best to be as informative as I can be. And please, folks, feel free to interrupt me at any time and ask questions if you feel the need. Chris and Jeff, we've got to stop meeting like this. We've been in Honolulu together, and we've been in Las Vegas together. And, you know, except I guess Jeff didn't make that one, but Chris did.
I have to work once in a while.
I gave a rather long-winded talk at the RSVC luncheon a little earlier. So if any of you attended that gathering, please don't hesitate to take a nap for the next few minutes, and I'll wake you up as soon as I get to the good stuff. As an ACB affiliate chapter, I'm sure you're more up to speed on national blindness issues such as the paper currency battle than I am. And you're even more in the know because more than most, not just because you're Californians, but because you got the greatest resource in the country, and that's Chris Gray. I thought to start with, I'd give you a few statistics about the Randolph-Shepard Blind Vending Facility program. For example, from the latest national statistics compiled for fiscal year 2005, excuse me, the average blind vendor's income was $43,584. That's a pretty good income. The vendors in total brought in $661.3 million in that year. Quite a substantial enterprise. In fact, at one point, they were considered to be the seventh largest food service operation in the country. I don't know if that's still the case or not. The number of blind vendors in 2005 was 2,564. Now, if you didn't know any better, you'd think that the program is doing quite well. The fact is, however, in 1973, more than 33 years ago and a year before the major expansion of the Randolph-Shepard Act, the total number of blind vendors was about 3,400. That's more than 800 above the number of vendors that were in the country this past year. Now, that trend would seem to be moving in the wrong direction. When we wrote the 1974 amendments to the Randolph-Shepard Act, the law asserted that if all obstacles were removed to the growth of the program, it could double within 5 years. That would be nearly 7,000 blind vendors as early as 1979. Not only did the program not meet expectations, it declined drastically, as you can see. A lot of external factors work to keep the number low. Increased security in federal buildings, that reduced the number of potential patrons and customers for blind vendors. Downsizing of both state and federal government workforces. The competition from food courts and groups such as franchises, Quiznos and Subways and McDonald's and so forth. And finally, of course, the continued hostility of federal agencies toward the program and the evasion by military installations toward paying vending machine income to state programs. It seems that the blind vendors over the years have constantly had to fight for their program and for their futures. And sometimes they have to fight the state licensing agencies that are supposed to help and advance them. And the fight continues. Indeed, it's become accelerated and has become more threatening to the vendors' livelihoods. And that's what I'm leading up to now. The current battle involves, at least superficially, military dining contracts. Two federal appeals courts have agreed that the priority accorded blind vendors in the Randolph-Shepard Act applies to military troop feeding, and that the priority is superior to the general preference for Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act agencies that provide direct labor and service contracts for severely disabled people who are not able to be competitively employed. Those court decisions galvanized NISH, formerly known as the National Industries for the Severely Handicapped, which receives 4% of the gross contract revenues for its operations, and its constituent consumer groups such as Goodwill, the ARC, United Cerebral Palsy Association, and others. Even though these groups hold hundreds of contracts, federal contracts, including more than 100 food service contracts that should have been awarded to Randolph-Shepard programs, these groups want even more. During negotiating sessions with these groups, national blindness organizations, including ACB, agreed to support legislation that would require blind vendors and state agencies for the blind holding military dining contracts to subcontract with NISH community rehabilitation agencies for mess attendant and other support services. But NISH didn't buy that proposal, and I suspect the reason for it is that they would lose their 4% commission on these contracts. Well, where is the situation now? A lady named Connie Garner, who is a professional staff member to Senator Ted Kennedy, and Senator Kennedy is the chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, is determined to open up the Randolph-Shepard Act to people with other disabilities. Instead of expanding employment for people who are disabled in another way, all this would do would be to cut blind people out of vending facility jobs, further shrinking the benefits of this 70-year-old program. I don't know the extent to which other HELP committee staff support this approach, because the HELP committee hasn't taken any action yet on military dining or other legislation that might affect the Randolph-Shepard program. But what I do know is that there's a pervasive settlement on the Hill that supports the one-size-fits-all approach to disability and that opposes any categorical programs. As you very well know, blindness is a low-incidence disability, and when the anti-categorialists are in charge, there's a strong likelihood that programs for the blind will be trampled on. And that's why it's so vital for blind people and their organizations and their supporters to speak up loudly and often and with one voice. And if that happens, the small numbers won't mean quite so much. Going back to the military dining fight, Congress for 2 years froze contracts that were in effect on the date of enactment so that where state licensing agencies held Randolph-Shepard contracts, those would remain as Randolph-Shepard contracts. There are now about 42 of those in the country. Where NISH agencies held the contracts, they would stay with NISH, and any new contracts would be subject to the Randolph-Shepard priority. And just for your information, there are about 100 NISH contracts for the same thing that the Randolph-Shepard program has priority for, more than twice the number of Randolph-Shepard vendors in that position. In October of 2005, the Senate Help Committee held a hearing on both Randolph-Shepard and Javits-Wagner-O'Day programs. The committee staff had developed a report that essentially asserted that a few millionaires benefited from Randolph-Shepard military dining contracts and that a few NISH contractor community rehabilitation programs were ripping off the government. We told the committee that the allegations about Randolph-Shepard were false and misleading. As a result of the hearing and the HELP company committee's renewed but misguided interest in Randolph-Shepard, the major blindness groups in the country, and also including the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind, got together and agreed to work concurrently and in concert, and are now called the Blind Entrepreneurs Alliance. The several groups, along with the food service teaming partners, have raised a war chest of more than $200,000 to combat the effects and the effort to diminish the blind vendor program. The focus of our attack is both the Congress and the Department of Defense, which has never been a big fan of our blind vendor program. At the request of the Alliance, I developed a draft bill that would expand Randolph Shepherd and create new initiatives in private sector jobs and other employment, along with loans for blind businesses. We asked Senator Enzi, the chairman of the committee then, and Senator Ted Kennedy, the ranking minority member then, to introduce the bill, but they never responded to us. There are a number of concerns that the Blind Alliance is currently addressing. First, Congress mandated the Department of Education and the Department of Defense, as well as the overreaching JWAD organization, the Committee for Purchase from Blind and Other Severely Disabled People, to develop a joint policy on the treatment of military dining contracts. And as expected, the so-called joint policy development was dominated by DOD, the 800-pound gorilla. And now DOD, we think, is trying to get that policy enacted into law, even though it's contrary, we think, currently to the Randolph-Shepherd law and regulations. We need to contact as many key members of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees as possible to keep that from happening. The Government Accountability Office is investigating the Randolph-Shepherd programs of several states along with NISH agency contracts. The Department of Education is developing performance standards for the Randolph-Shepherd program, also under that partial provision that the Congress adopted, and is also working on regulations that would implement the joint policy. And finally, the Inspectors General of Department of Defense and Education have been directed by Congress to review Randolph-Shepherd and Javits-Wagner-O'Day programs. Just this morning, in fact, I got word that the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Defense wants to have a meeting with the Blind Entrepreneurs Alliance next week, and they have asked me to participate as well, so I'm going to go to that meeting and see what's going on. And then the following week, the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind and a number of blind vendors are also going to go up and talk with the Inspector General for the Department of Defense. Finally, the Department of Transportation, this is yet another issue, just issued a final policy document on the so-called OASIS program, which basically is to establish new opportunities for businesses off interstate highway access routes. And that is a proposal that could negatively affect the blind vendors operating vending machines at highway rest stops. So you can see that we're pretty beleaguered all over the place, and the challenges to Randolph-Shepherd are many. We all need to address them directly and vigorously, and any help you folks can provide would be greatly appreciated and could save some blind vendors' jobs. So thank you for listening, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for Bob Humphreys?
I have one for the Resolutions Committee. Do we have a resolution for Bob to take with him?
Kathy is asking if we have a resolution on this issue.
Mr. Chairman?
I think Gabe is having a meeting at the moment, but Mitch.
Yeah.
You want to get to a microphone, Mitch, if you go to the aisle?
I'm dogless for right now. So
here, Mitch.
Out of my way.
Well...
Here I am. Chris, we actually just completed, before I came in here, we have two resolutions addressing the state program. Not necessarily ready to go now because they're still meeting, but we have one dealing with establishing a position for location development here in California, since the number of facilities has gone down dramatically, and a second position, a second resolution regarding bringing the recruitment effort for the program manager, because that position is soon to be vacant, to establish a national search for that position. So those resolutions will be coming before the body tomorrow morning regarding our state program.
Can any of those be modified so that we give some help to the federal thing
we're
talking about?
Kathy, we don't currently have anything in regard to that. I don't recall, Chris, have we not had... what did we have last summer? I was not on the national committee, so I don't recall what we had last summer insofar as assisting Bob and RSVA.
Historically, we have a number of resolutions that provide support from ACB for the Randolph Shepherd program. I don't quite know. We'd have to talk with Bob, I think, offline about the possibility of doing anything right now.
I mean, if there's a need for something specific, we can certainly take that back to the committee. We'll likely be meeting subsequent to the banquet, but
yeah,
that's what we've got right now.
Okay. Yeah, Bob,
well, I think,
Bob, and the question is, what could CCB do this weekend to help the Randolph Shepherd program?
Well, I think just an expression of support for the activities of the Blind Entrepreneurs Alliance would be useful, and a commitment from CCB to work with members of Congress and senators to see if, number one, we can get legislation introduced to support the establishment of this blind entrepreneurship and business enterprise agency that I mentioned. Basically, it would transfer the Randolph Shepherd program to the Department of Commerce and expand the Randolph Shepherd program to include private entrepreneurship as well as other activities. So if those things were addressed, I don't know that it's necessary to do it by resolution, but I think it would be very welcome if you folks could endorse the concepts.
Perhaps we can do something by motion tomorrow at our business meeting. Other questions for Bob?
Here it is.
Thank you. First of all, I want to greet you, Bob, as from a previous life. I remember before you were RSA commissioner, when you were Senate staff, and you wrote the 73 Rehab Act, including Section 504. I was hanging around with Eunice Fiorito and the American Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities in those days. But I wanted to ask you, is there a possibility that besides all the things you were talking about, one of the problems about the Randolph Shepherd Act is that it's an affirmative action program, and those are out of favor these days?
That is a worry and something that I've tried to keep out of my head because I don't need any more things to worry about. But as Roger so properly recognizes, there's been a lot of activity both in the previous Congresses and in the Supreme Court to either strike down or nullify or modify affirmative action programs. And some people do consider Randolph Shepherd to be affirmative action in that it is provides assistance to people and provides a priority in the operation of vending facilities over and above any opportunity afforded other people who are not disabled. So it's something I worry about, certainly, but basically I've kind of learned to take problems one step at a time and put out the fires as they come because I don't have time to do anything else.
Okay, do we have other questions?
Yes, one more question.
You haven't come forward. There's a
People do. If you do have questions, yeah. Come forward.
I have a question.
Okay. Who are you?
This is Ed Crespin. I'm a voc rehab counselor. And
go
some
ahead.
Of the things that I've seen with the business enterprise program is the buying power of the vendors, because you're really basically an independent vendor. And what I'd like to see is the buying power where somehow we can start warehousing and buying goods for the program itself and distributing them to the different vendors throughout California. What's happened is some of these vendors are buying from, Costco, Smart and Final. And it's much easier for them if they had a warehouse where they can call their order in and it can get delivered. Why not compete with these other companies who are warehousing to them? And it would help in the cost to go down, because a lot of vendors are paying too much for product.
Ed, thank you. That's an excellent idea. I would assume that the California Vendors Policy Committee and RSVW have addressed that issue sometime in the past. One thing that I think is potentially could be helpful in that regard would be to establish a so-called nominee agency that would have a not-for-profit organization take over the operation of the business enterprise program, the Randolph-Shepard program in the state. California is clearly big enough to sustain the kind of activity that you suggest, and I think it's also big enough to create this nominee presence, which would allow, I think, a much more effective operation of the program in terms of not only buying commodities, produce, and so forth, and materials for the program, but and for individual vendors, and establishing that warehouse you mentioned, but also purchasing equipment and renovating, repairing equipment. A nominee agency, in my very strong view, and I know there are some who don't agree with it, but I think that a nominee could do purchasing and volume buying outside the state procurement system, and in that way make things a whole lot cheaper than they are now.
Thank you. Bob, I'd like to ask you one question, and this will be the final question this afternoon for this topic. You touched on something that I think is vitally important, and I wonder if I can ask you to expand on it a wee bit. And that is the whole issue of categorical services versus generic services. I think that we know in the blind community that the assault on categorical services is the worst thing that has ever happened to the blind community in terms of rehab services. And yet, we have not done the job that has carried the message back to Congress or even a lot of administrators about our needs for categorical services. Do you have any perspective you can share with us about how we as a community can be more effective in communicating the needs of and the advantages for our group of categorical services?
Yeah. As you know, and probably everybody in this room knows, ACB has forever been supportive of categorical services and has expressed itself in a number of ways philosophically about the need for categorical services for the blind. I think that whole concept needs to be reappraised and brought up to date. And I think that one thing that is very sorely needed is one or more champions for the blind community. We simply don't have that. And I think that has to be cultivated, and I'm talking primarily about people in the House and the Senate, to act as a continuing positive force for the retention of categorical services. Because I think that the same thing is happening in blindness generally as is happening in the Randolph Shepherd program. That is that there is both a diminution of interest in blindness as a disability. There's a diminution of interest in disability generally among the population and among members of Congress. And there's an awful lot of fallacious assumptions out there that need to be corrected, one of which is this one-size-fits-all concept that everybody should have the same treatment, the same VR, the same everything, because it just doesn't work that way. And I think if you guys are able to mount a national campaign that includes that whole issue, I think it would be very beneficial, not only in that regard, but in a variety of other ways.
Great. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Humphreys.
Thank you all. Good to see you.
Okay, Jeff. Well, we've had a good presentation about a nationwide issue that affects California, and so it's very important. But we also need at every one of our conventions to have an update on what's happening right here in California in our own state Department of Rehabilitation. We have a person here, I'll stop thinking of her after today as the new Jim Armstrong. But a person who I'm delighted to hear from, and I know you will be too, she is the program manager of Services for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Kathy Vales.
Hello, everyone. I am so very, very happy to be here and so happy to be the new program manager, district administrator for Blind Field Services of Department of Rehabilitation. It's truly my honor. And I hope that I can represent not only the department well, but all of you well, every blind and visually impaired person here in the state of California. That's our goal. You know, specialized services for the blind and visually impaired and deaf and hard of hearing, that division came about in July of 2003. But it was because of all of you and others like you pushing the legislature to say, we need to have specialized services. We need to have people who are well-trained in understanding the needs of the blind and visually impaired and those who are deaf and hard of hearing. We need to have our own specialized program. And that's why we came about. And that's why we have 68 counselors who are well-trained and getting even more trained to be able to serve our consumers. The SSD, or Specialized Services Division, is headed by Tony Candela. He's our deputy director. And he sends his regrets that he was unable to attend today. But I'm grateful that he was unable to attend today, that he's out there some other part of the country. He took off. And I know what he's doing, and it's very important. But he asked me if I could come and speak on his behalf. And I am truly honored to do that. I hope that Tony will be able to speak to you at a later time. I was able to speak with the those who attended the fall conference in October down in L.A., and that was really a joy. You know, the Specialized Services Division is made up of several programs. And I know Mike Cole was here today, and Dana, and they were with OCB, Orientation Center for the Blind, and I'm sure he gave you an update on what's going on there. I know that they're very happy to be fully staffed now, and they took one of our counselors, Thomas Franks, to be a computer trainer and instructor for their programs, and I know Thomas, and he's very, very good. So it's a wonderful addition to the OCB program. We're hoping to have more and more of our consumers be able to go to OCB so that they can gain those independent adjustment to blindness skills that are so extremely important, from Braille and orientation and mobility training to all the other ways of learning to get around and just feel confident about being somebody who has vision loss and getting out there in the community, just like all of you are doing. The other programs that we have are the BEP, the Blind Enterprise Program, and of course we have training going on right now. We just had, I believe, 8 students that have been completing their training with BEP and are now getting placed out in the community as vendors, and we're really excited about how well they have done. The other programs that we have, of course, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and that's headed by Tim Beatty. And we're working in a real collaborative spirit because we have so many of our consumers who are deaf-blind. So between all of our services and the expertise that's available, we really are trying to provide the best possible services to those individuals. The BFS program, of course, is the one that I happen to know best. And I am excited about what we're doing. We have 68 counselors all throughout the state. We've just hired 8 new counselors. And I got to be in on so many of those interviews, and I am so excited about who these individuals are and how they're going to be working with our consumers. And many of them come to us with a great deal of experience in working with people who are blind or visually impaired, and others are going to need some new training, and so we are busy getting them prepared for their caseloads. Alice Hackney is helping us with that, and you all know Alice, I'm sure. And they're also going up to SAF for a rehab technology training for a couple days of that. And we're just having them really get immersed in the kind of training that they need to have so that they are really qualified to provide services to our consumers, those with vision loss. We also have just hired a new rehab supervisor, and that is Grace Marino, and she's at our Bakersfield office. And yeah, let's hear it for Grace. You bet. Thank you. Thank you. I'm thrilled to have Grace as one new person on our management team, and she's going to have a great deal to offer all of us. And in fact, would you mind if I ask how many are counselors here? Who are the VR counselors here in the room? And if they could please stand up. And then if we can please, how many are here? I know Ed is here. Yeah, Ed, how many others are here? Hi, Tricia. There you are. Good. Any others? Speak up. Okay, I would like you to give them a hand. I tell you, I'm going to need it. These counselors, I know the work that they put in to serving our consumers, and I am so very, very proud to work with each and every one of them. They have very complex caseloads. Yes, our clients have vision loss, but so many of them have so many other types of disabilities as well. And so between mobility concerns and problems to psychiatric disabilities to hearing loss, as we've talked about, the list goes on. And so not only do they have to be well-versed, well-trained in vision loss, they must have good skills and knowledge in people with all types of disabilities. And they do indeed have that, and they're acquiring new skills as we speak. In fact, next month, in May 14th and 15th, we will be putting on what we call our SB 105 training. Now, we're calling it SB 105 training because of the legislation that brought us into being, the SB 105. And because of that, we are required every year to provide our counseling staff and our supervisors with specialized training concerning people with vision loss. And that will be going on. We're going to be trying to have a greater understanding of how we can develop even more effective individual plans for employment. We call them fondly IPEs. And so we're going to be learning how to really get the meat of the information that we need to have up front so that we can develop those kind of plans with our consumers so that they can indeed move ahead and become very successful, that they will be on the other side and they will be learning their skills, their acquiring their education at our colleges, universities, and community colleges, and then going out there into the workforce, but in the vocational plans that really are going to be effective for them. And we'll work with them as a team on that. All of our services, we work together with our consumers. You know, we last year, we had 450 vocational placements. That's a lot of vocational placements. Thank you to the counselors. Thank you to all the consumers for all the hard work that they put into that. This year, we anticipate about 400. Now, that's considerably less. It doesn't mean that they're any less important. Oh, my goodness. We're excited about it. But you know what? Our applications have been a bit lower in the past 2 years. So I want to call on all of you to work with us in trying to get more applications, more referrals to the Department of Rehabilitation. We really need to have your assistance. I'm not sure what's happened, but you know, it's not just with our caseloads. It's throughout the department that there seems to have been a lower number of referrals. Well, we want to let the word be out there that our doors are open, that we are here to provide services, that we are looking forward to meeting our new consumers. So if you know of somebody, and I think you might, know somebody with a vision loss who is now thinking about going to work, then I want you to refer them to the Department of Rehabilitation, and we want to help them towards that goal. In fact, we've just started a new task force. Our task force is concerning our transition program. That transition program is for our high school students, 16 years of age to 22. And we are going to be, Richard Ruida and I are going to head up this task force. How many of you know Richard? Anybody here? Thought you might. Well, I think Richard and I got together yesterday here at the lunchroom or the cafe here, restaurant, and we sat down and we've been talking along the way, but yesterday we sat down and we talked about our vision for this task force, how we want to have a counselor from each of our units throughout the state to work with us on this task force, to go out to our high schools and our communities, to let the high schools know who we are, what we can do, that we're here to work with those young high school students to help them to have hope for the future, to talk to their parents, to help them not to be fearful of the future for their young people, that we can help those young people of theirs to achieve a wonderful career in the area that's right for them, so that they too, as they're hearing their peers talk about what they want to do when they grow up, they can chime in and talk about what they want to do when they grow up as well. We want to be a part of that. We want to help them to achieve those goals. And you know, with all the assistive technologies that are out there these days, people with vision loss can do just about anything. They just need some guidance. They need our support. They need good vocational rehabilitation counselors to show them the way, to be good mentors to them, to be good coaches to them. And they need all of you as well. So please, if you have high school students in your community that you don't think know about us yet, I think it's time they get to know us, don't you? So have them come, contact one of our counselors, and we'll be very anxious to meet with them and to get to work with them. We, even though they're 16, we'll work alongside of them while they're at school, and we'll help them to start working towards their transition from high school to work, high school to work experiences while they're in school, and then when they leave high school, maybe going on to the community colleges and universities, whatever's right for them. As we all know, our services are very individualized. It depends upon that person, upon what their interests and abilities and capabilities are. And you know, we have so many good programs out there, like SAF, and such as the Society for the Blind, and the JBA, and, oh my goodness, you know, you know them all as well as I do, and I don't want to be amiss and not mention them all, so I'm not going to try to make a full list of them. I know I would miss one because I'm a little nervous up here. No. Anyway, in fact, I saw some of you at Catherine Campisi's retirement. Were some of you in the room, were they there at Catherine's retirement on Thursday night? I know Ken Metz was. We ran into each other, literally. that was fun. But we had a wonderful retirement party for Catherine Campisi. And she, you know, one of her main loves was helping young people to achieve greater independence and to achieve successful employment goals and outcomes for their lives. So in carrying that tradition on, we with Blind Field Services, we believe the same thing. With our supervisors, I just thought I'd bring you up to date. We do have 9 supervisors within our Blind Field Services section all over the state. We just replaced Pat Lamont with Grace Marino. But then, now guess what? I get to replace myself down in San Diego. So that's going to be interesting. I'm going to be conducting interviews in the next month or less. And so I'm looking forward to finding out who that replacement's going to be. And then one of our counselors, Peter Dawson. How many of you know Peter Dawson? Yeah. Well, I had some sad news. Peter has defected. Now, that's what I'm calling it. Peter has decided to leave Blind Field Services just for now to gain some new experiences with rehab. And he's going over to our San Diego district. And he's going to be a generalist counselor. So it's my responsibility now to replace Peter. I don't think that really can be done. But I'm going to have a counselor that will take his caseload. So we will be fully staffed there in the next month or so. Let me see. What else do I want to share with you? Our elderly, our older blind population, we've served over 4,000 people who are 55 years and older during this past year. Now, that's quite a few. And we know with the baby boomer generation that there will be an increase of blind or visually impaired senior citizens that will be needing our services in the future. So we are ready to do that. Our Title VII Chapter 2 programs, we're going to be having some new RFPs that are going to be going out. Our requests for proposals are going to be going out shortly. So if you're connected with one of those community rehab programs, I would like you to be aware that information will be coming to you, and I encourage you to apply for Title VII Chapter 2 funding. We really, really need your assistance in providing services with us to our senior citizens. And it's really going to be it's going to be a challenge for all of us to be able to provide quality services to those that are 55 and older. What's been fun is that so many times when an older person comes to us, we may assume right away that they are not interested in work, but are here for the homemaker services. But do you know how many people nowadays are really coming in and they want to continue to work? Just like with the population that isn't blind or visually impaired, people with who are retired or have a reason to get additional income because their Social Security benefits just aren't cutting it enough anymore. So they too are wanting to return to work. So on our caseloads, we do indeed have a number of people who are 60, 65 years old and are wanting to go to work, and many of them are indeed finding employment. So that's pretty exciting that they can do that. Let me see. Anybody else I should be thinking about here? I just want to make sure that you understand that BFS, Blind Field Services, is healthy and well. I'm thrilled to be now the new program manager. I don't think I could ever take Jim Armstrong's place. I would never try to. I was in his office yesterday and it felt a little unusual. And then what happened? But he came to the door. I couldn't believe it. I heard a voice that sounded too familiar. And I turned my head, and there was Jim Armstrong. And he says, "Who's sitting in my chair?" And I went, "Oh, my goodness." So it was a wonderful way to begin by having Jim come and wish me well. And I just hope that I can be as good of a program manager as Jim has been for us. And I know I'm going to learn a lot from him. He's going to be there to give me some guidance along the way. But I want the guidance to come from all of you as well. I'd like to open it up and see if you have any questions. I really do better with that. If you have some questions, please just feel free to ask me, and I'll do the best I can, okay?
For questions, please come to the center aisle, and we have volunteers and Ed and others to help you to a microphone. Kathy, thank you. I think that was a great introduction to yourself. Appreciate your commitment. And I'd like to recognize President Jeff Tom for the first question.
Thank you, Chris. Kathy, congratulations again on your appointment.
Thank you, Jeff.
Question about OCB. We're thrilled that the Orientation Center is fully staffed. That's outstanding. We have some concerns, however, that attendance there is dropping. I know that the procedures to allow persons in to the center are very rigorous and time-consuming. What can the department do to turn the situation around and make sure that there are more people? Because we know that the need is there.
Okay, well, number one, we have to make sure that our counselors are making appropriate referrals. That's one thing. And I really think they are. I think once in a great while something happens where it isn't the appropriate referral, and then that might just, I'm afraid, make people at OCB a little bit more cautious. I hope I'm saying it right. They're a little bit more cautious in making sure that the person that's being referred is absolutely the right referral. And we care so much about their staff as well. And yes, there have been some concerns with a referral here and there. But that certainly isn't the general rule for the referrals that are coming from our counselors. So I'm hoping that with some guidance from me, from Tony Candela, from our counselors, our supervisors, that we can help OCB to work on what their screening method is for making referrals. And I want to be a part of that team as we help them to understand our consumers a little better, and so that more people can be referred and that they can then receive the services that they so vitally need. Does that help?
Thank you, yes.
Okay.
We have a few people in line. Who has the next question?
My name is Jim Livingston, and I'm from the elderly group. Okay.
So am I. Okay.
I've been through the training program at OCB, and I appreciated it very much. My concern is for the baby boomers that are coming forth, and many of them are going to be developing macular degeneration and becoming blind as adults.
Right.
While the emphasis on preparing people to go into a job situation is wonderful, I think many of these people are going to need just living skills. And I'm thinking that maybe there could be some additional programs that would be developed for doing that. And I can think of several that would be comparable to or similar to the senior retreat program that the Society for the Blind has.
Right.
And some of those people, I think, and I've planted this idea in Mike Cole's head also, that they might adjust the program there to take in a group of people. And I think if you're working with seniors, you might have to change things a little bit. They might not want a teenage roommate. And so, or maybe they would.
Wait a minute. Maybe they would.
Maybe. Yes. But I would just like to ask you to give those things some thought and to think about that group that is coming through, because it's going to be a large group.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
And I appreciate what your thought was.
I think, Dirk, you're next.
Okay.
Hi, Dirk Nyher, Berkeley Chapter.
Hi, Dirk.
I have a couple things. One, what's your budget, and when will every blind person have a computer screen reading software and DSL all over California? That's one question. The next question is, how come there are only two of the 68 blind services representatives here? And what award do you have to give to people like Patricia Leitz, who single-handedly placed more than 5% of the placement last year and worked 60-hour weeks for a hair shirt?
Tricia, did you ask him to say that?
Anyway, Patricia's not my counselor, but I do think her inevitable destination is Sacramento, and I hope she does not leave the Bay Area.
Well, I do too, but wherever Tricia goes, I see great things for her. Hi, Kathy. Why there's only two counselors here, I have no idea. Where are they? Now, I know there were others that were here yesterday and the day before. And I was only here for a little while yesterday. So I know there's a youth summit that's going on right now. And so some of them are there. And so I'm not sure where else they are, but I apologize that more aren't here. But you certainly have two extremely good ones here, Ed Crespin and also with Tricia Leet. Please, I mean, if we're going to have the department represented, to have both of them here at the same time, no less, I think that's pretty extraordinary right there. So I thank them for being here, and I wish more were here as well. And Tricia, yes, I know well of your placement rating, and I'm thrilled with it. And Tricia does a wonderful job. I hope she's not working 60 hours a week, Tricia. But I think she is the type of counselor that is very representative of the majority of our counselors. They keep working until they get the job done. They care so much about their consumers, about their clients, and Ed Crespin is the same way, and they are eager to do the job. I mean, they have a passion, and that's what I think I have too. We have a passion to really work with our consumers, to try to provide them with the best possible services that we can. And it's not easy, and it's not a 9-to-5 job, that's for sure. I'm afraid all of us, we take it home with us, and we live it. Okay.
Kathy.
Thank you, Dirk.
Kathy, this is Kathy.
Hello, Kathy.
Good Kathy, to see you. As you probably know, on May 9th, I will conduct my first Blind Advisory Committee of the Department of Corporation as chair.
And that will be my first time that I will be with you as PM for that.
And my question was, can you be with us? And I want you to know that we are hopeful that you're going to come. And I wanted, at this convention, I'm talking about people. And I want to say that recently, you know, Jeff and I get a lot of referrals. I guess we all do, but we kind of sometimes, I think, get more than our share. Anyway, I had a case that was pretty difficult, and I got to Kathy. And then I went back up to Tony, and he sent me back to Kathy.
Yes, he did.
And Kathy took care of it. We had a gentleman who wanted to work. He has a little unusual case. He wants to be self-employed. And I don't know, Kathy, you have some challenges. She did. My point is, she took care of the problem. She helped a person, and she did it in a few days.
I enjoyed it too.
And you're going to have a challenge, Kathy, because I've worked a lot for this organization, and they pay me with zeros, and they haven't put anything in front of that yet. So I think the real challenge for your counselors will be, I want a paying job, and I'm about to fill out an application.
Okay. Come right ahead. Okay.
Okay, I believe Norma
Thank you,
is
Kathy.
Next.
Hi, Kathy. My name is Norma Guerrero, and I want to say thank you to on behalf of the Spanish-speaking community. Blindfield Services is now working with people who are Spanish-speaking and orienting them to English, those of us that are partially sighted and blind. And in the community, the Hispanic community is very, very pleased to have that hand extended to them through you in working with the Society for the Blind as well, in getting these services to those of us that need it, and utilizing those of us that are bilingual to help each other.
Yes.
You guys are really fostering some wonderful things happening. Spanish-speaking people are learning English, and they're learning skills through the Department of Rehab and all the services in our area now. And it's just a wonderful thing. I want to say thank you.
Well, muchas gracias.
De parte de nosotros.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, two of our new... Okay, we hired another counselor. Jesse Dominguez had retired, and so Annabelle Ramos is now a Spanish-speaking bilingual counselor at in our El Centro office, and she's excellent. I think you're all going to get to know her, and she is wonderful.
Hi, my name is Haley Edick. I just had a quick question. I'm nearing my end of needing rehab services in California. I'm moving up to Washington.
Oh.
But something that I've noticed as a difficulty for me is that my counselor has told me that they can't get anything in accessible format when they're visually impaired, which I kind of doubt that. But I wasn't able to get my IEP stuff in Braille. I had to sign it. I got every paper I got in the mail, I didn't know where to sign.
Okay.
It's really illogical for me to find someone when I never knew about in-home support services. It's very difficult to find someone to help access this print media when I'm working for a division of the government that is trying to help me. I'm just wondering if I missed something or if there's something that you can help do to improve this.
Well, I certainly hope I can help to improve this. And because we should be able to provide you with materials and with assistive technologies that will enable you to access the information that you're provided. So please continue to talk to your counselor when that's appropriate, and just keep saying, I need this in accessible format.
One problem I had was I was told to scan it, which I could do just fine, but then how do I know where
to sign? But how do you know how to write? Yes.
Where do I know to sign? And I assume that I can sign anywhere, and it'll be okay because that's all I can do.
That's what you can do.
Thank you.
We would certainly accept it.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Kathy Vales, thank you very much for this great presentation.
Thank you, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've announced the meetings. We'll see many of you tonight at 7 o'clock right here in Eagleberry Essa for the banquet. And please be here at 9 o'clock sharp tomorrow for the next general session. We are now in recess. Thank you for your attention.